on the banks of the Yarra, where we sat down and lit the sacred fire to worship Banjo. Camp Sovereignty.
Hi everyone, my name's Robbie Thorpe. As you know, it's Disability Week, and my show, Bunzel's Fire, we're a part of that, and we're going to be giving up our show to the crew called Right Relations. And I just want to add that down there at Camp Sovereignty, we've got an issue of accessibility of that site. It's a very important site where the remains of Aboriginal people came from out of the museum and Melbourne University. In 1985, I was there, actually. Sort of tell the story about what happened to Aboriginal people. So it's a very important site in a very important space. It's only taken 40 years to look at this issue. But it sort of reflects on how Aboriginal people are treated when it comes to our rights. Yeah, the site is on a very steep slope in the Botanical Gardens, in what they call the King's Domain, also known as Camp Sovereignty. Now, if you had a disability, you'd struggle to go and see that site. This is a National Heritage listed site, so you'd struggle to go and see that. If you was in a wheelchair, there's no way you could access the site. So this is a real issue, and I just think it's the way this country treats Aboriginal people. It's symbolic of that. Now, there's no signage for this site. There's a few other issues. So we're intending to build a ramp which makes it legal, because at the moment it's not. And I think we've got a real chance to make some changes down there at Camp Sovereignty. And if you know that area, you'll see that every other site there has got disability access to it. Why haven't Aboriginal people got that for their site? So that's starting to, it's starting to be a bit of a traction on that now. Melbourne City Council is actually taken some notice where they have to. You know, we're entitled to that sort of access too. We have a lot of disability in our own communities, but that's not just for Aboriginal people. Anybody who wanted to visit that site, you know, they're entitled to that. So that's an issue right at this moment. And so if you want more information, you can contact me here at 3CR. My name's Robbie Thorpe. And so get in touch with me and we'll explain a bit further. But we just wanted to add that to the Disability Week and mention it. Disability access for heritage listed sites there's no argument there. So it should happen, but we'll make sure it does. There's also an article in CBD News, came out last week, that covers the issue a bit more. Not just that issue, but that was in the accessibility issue of that site. Like I said, it's on an impossible angle. It makes me wonder if that was deliberately done or that was some other reason for that, but the fact is that it needs disability access. We've had a number of elders who would like to see that site. It's very important. It tells you a little bit about the history of this place, and also it tells you a little bit about how people have been treated too, so hopefully that will change in the very near future. I just thought I'd add that because it's a Disability Week this week. On the issue of disability, it's sort of a weird sort of thing because our people didn't see anybody as a disability. You mightn't have a leg, you mightn't have all the abilities of what they call an able-bodied person, but you were no different, treated no differently. And even people who had other issues like mental issues, that weren't seen as disability either. In fact, sometimes people who had those issues could see more than anybody. So that, we actually seen all people as human beings deserving rights as well, no matter who they were. So just maybe need to take a leaf out of the Aboriginal people's book on the way that we treat people, all people. So I hope that can change, and not just there, anywhere else where they're denying our people or anybody who may be what they call disabled or have a disability the opportunity to partake in enjoying these places or just acknowledging these places, visiting these places.
Constitutionally, Old people are free to practice religious ceremony, but not the Aborigine.
Good morning. You're tuned in to 3CR Community Radio's Disability Day broadcast. My name is Pauline Vituna. I'm the Disability Day worker, and for the next hour, I'm presenting this program titled Right Relations. I want to take a moment first to acknowledge all sovereign peoples of the Greater Kulin Nation as the true custodians of the lands I live on, specifically the Bunurong people, as well as the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, from whose lands this program is being broadcast. I pay my respects to ancestors and elders, and acknowledge my responsibility as a migrant who has settled on this land, and as an Indigenous person from the Pacific, from Papua, my responsibility to both my own peoples, who face ongoing colonial capitalist oppression, as well as my responsibility to nurture right relations with this country and the First Peoples of this land. And in a small way, that's kind of what this program is about today. Bunurong people say that Bunjil's law has it that guests who are welcomed on this land are to look after land and water and also look after the children of Bunjil. And on today's program, we're going to be hearing the voices of Aboriginal friends I'm in relation to, as well as elders I deeply respect, talking about care for children, for young people, and for country. All have a lived experience of disability and ability, including as a direct result of colonisation. I'm also going to be chatting with you a little bit just about elder care and some changes that have occurred at a legislative level that are affecting the way Aboriginal elders are cared for, as well as elders from migrant of colour communities and vulnerable white settler seniors as well. At the very beginning of this hour, you heard the voice of Uncle Robbie Thorpe, who generously gave us an education on accessibility for disabled people at the Camp Sovereignty Sacred Site, which is all about taking care of both community and taking care of the ancestors at the site. So, I've got a lot of things to play for you in the next 50 minutes, so let's get into it. I'm going to call this first segment Care for Children, and it's an interview about homeschooling for Indigenous and disabled kids with my friend and comrade and the 2025 Disability Day poster artist, Renee Barker-Mulholland.
My name is Renee Barker-Mulholland. I'm a proud Biripi Dungari woman, currently on Wadawurrung country. I call myself a black of all trades because that's the kind of best and most succinct way to describe my approach to life, I suppose.
Beautiful. And I wanted to talk to you today about education and specifically about homeschooling, because we've talked before about the sovereign rights of children and, you know, navigating systems that weren't set up for children, either Indigenous kids or disabled kids, and you happen to be raising both.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you today about that.
Yeah.
So when your eldest child, Hendrix, was born, he was born with a disability, and today he's a teenager, and you're homeschooling him. So could you tell us the story of your journey into homeschooling your child, and why you chose this path for your family?
I love telling the story, so thank you for the opportunity to share it. So yeah, Hendrix was my first child. I was pretty young and very unprepared for what eventuated when he was born. He was really unwell when he was born, and he was in the ICU for a few months. And so we went on a really steep learning curve as first-time parents, learning about what it means to have a child with a disability. So that's sort of the genesis of everything, is when we started learning about sort of the obstacles that our child might face and the different ways to look at the world. So part of his disability is that he needed extra time. And so by the time he got to school, by the time he got to school age, we were already, you know, advocating for him to have access to things to support his disability within the school environment. So he did attend his first year of school at a public school, And it was during those 12 months that I saw so much of the progress that he had made in navigating the world with his disability disappear. I saw all of that sort of spark from him enjoying life gradually get less and less over the course of that year. And I mean, I'd already considered homeschooling as an option, but I had a lot of things on my plate. I had a newborn baby. I was caring for my parent who was really unwell, and I had a disability myself that was developing quite rapidly. So I felt like sending him to school was the thing that I had to do. But we eventually got to the stage where we said to him, you know, how about for a little while we just try what it's like to live in the world as it is, but let's just say that we're homeschooling. And so when the school holidays came around, we acted like we were homeschoolers. And for us, that meant allowing Hendrix to do very sort of child-led or interest-based learning. And for him, that meant for the next 2 weeks, he just read and read and read the How to Train Your Dragon series. He was absolutely absorbed with that series. And so throughout those 2 weeks, not only did I see that spark of his coming back, but so many other factors in our life were impacted and benefited from that. It's kind of like the old, you know, if you build a ramp for someone with a wheelchair, it helps someone with a pram as well. That kind of idea that there was a flow-on effect from making this choice. And so I just saw the opportunity and thought, this has got to be for us. Like, this is, you know, this has so many things that are saying yes in my brain and felt right that I thought we'd give it a try. And yeah, that was over a decade ago now. And it's just gone from strength to strength for us. So yeah, I hope that kind of is a somewhat concise way of describing our journey of how we got here. But yeah, it was definitely doing things that felt right to us and that felt like they were the best for our child.
And your child's characteristics, because I remember you saying that he very early on he seemed more human focused.
Yes, when he was quite young, he was very, and I think that was kind of a reflection of his experience in the medical world as well. Like, he was very used to spending his days interacting with people as opposed to, you know, going to kinder, or it was more commonplace for him to go to hospital than it was for him to go to a kindergarten. So, but it definitely gave him that chance to sort of stay close to mum and in close to his family unit while being independent as well, and give him that confidence that brings.
Yeah, and connected to that first question, could you talk a little bit about how Montessori was an inspiration?
Yeah, so as a lot of sort of people in the, I got introduced to the idea of, I always forget what the words are for it. There's lots of fancy terms for it, but attachment parenting or kind of gentle parenting, I got into that researching those kind of theories on how we treat babies and how we help children develop. And yeah, that led me down the rabbit hole to Maria Montessori, who, you know, most places around would have a Montessori preschool or school, but I'm not sure that a lot of people would know about the actual woman that inspired it, who it was around in the 19th century anyway, and she wanted to teach children, and she wanted to teach children a new way. And in Italy, her colleagues all thought it was a very big joke, and they gave her a bunch of disabled children that they had written off as, you know, being no hopers, essentially, that could never learn or do anything. And yeah, she taught them using this method that allowed not only for self-care learning, so there was things about, you know, brushing your hair and cleaning up after yourself and things like that, but also the basics of mathematics and geography and sort of life lessons more than anything. Yeah, so she got given these disabled children, and of course, not to my surprise, but to a lot of people's surprise, these children flourished when they learnt underneath her. And yeah, the method has been exported around the world, but it was just that kind of idea that a woman who, like, I didn't finish high school, I don't have a university degree, but the idea that a woman that could be seen as lesser than, which I felt I was, could actually provide a really wonderful environment for children, especially children with disability. And that sort of really connected to the identity that I have of that I know how to be a black fella because it's who I am and it's part of who I am, and teaching that is part of everyday life. And so sort of the opportunity to combine cultural learning on top of life skills and learning in a way that was best for my child and that benefited my child was just, yeah, it was just like a whole new world had opened up, and I felt so much more relief and so much more hope for the future.
Sounds so good. And that's something that you said earlier when we were talking before this broadcast, was that you don't replicate the school environment outside of school.
Yeah, I think that's a really common misconception that people have. And it's certainly, I mean, there's benefits to the classroom environment. But if you're talking about, you know, a child with an energy-limiting disease maybe, or energy-limiting condition, maybe getting up at, you know, seven, I don't know what time people get up to go to school, but getting up early in the morning to go to a certain place every day isn't going to, you know, it's not going to benefit this person in the long run, and it's probably not going to help them learn very much. And so this idea that the school environment needs to be replicated is just not one that worked for us. And so being able to rise in the morning, I that was one thing I really struggled with, having a neurodivergent child as well, who, you know, he was 6, 7, 8 years old, and he was still, he would not sleep, you know, he would not sleep for 18 hours some days, and then he would sleep for 3 days in a row, like he would need to rest. And recognizing and not shaming him for those natural patterns were really important too in that development of his identity as a disabled person, because it, you know, for Hendrix, it was, he was going to be disabled for the rest of his life. So we had to make sure that that identity was supported as well, and in ways that meant were beneficial not only for his physical body but his mental body, or his mental health as well as his physical health. And you know, it just so happened to benefit us when we did it. And as I mentioned, I had a newborn baby when we first started homeschooling, and you know, being up in the middle of the night and being able to talk about, you know, oh, how come this happens in this story, or, you know, watching TV together and talking about videos that we're watching, or having those conversations at times when we're all able to be awake and functional. And that, you know, that was just, that was one thing that was just completely different from the mainstream sort of schooling environment, that it was about doing things when we could, as opposed to when we were required to, or when everybody else was there, you know.
So you've talked a lot already about the benefits of homeschooling your kids, but are there any other benefits that you haven't mentioned yet? So, for example, what are the needs being met for them at home as Indigenous and disabled kids that may not be met by mainstream institutionalized education? And also, there's probably some practical benefits to homeschooling children that people might not be aware of.
Yeah, so practically, I mean, logistically getting, as someone who, I use a wheelchair predominantly, and other members of my family have mobility challenges, so just practically not having to get everybody out together. Like, I mean, we have 2 or 3 walkers that come with us wherever we go, so not having to lug those things around and not having to expend that energy to conform to this idea that, you know, were in line with factory workers' hours, essentially. It's not reflective of the work and the work environment that we have these days anyway. And so I don't think it's an accurate reflection of It doesn't prepare them for the real world if their only choice is, you know, Monday to Friday between 9 and 3. That's just not an accurate reflection of the world. And so it was kind of not being tied to that kind of time frame, it still allowed us to work whenever, you know, my partner was working at a job that he was lucky enough to work from home before 2019. So there were lots of different little benefits that compounded to be practically so much better. But it also meant that we live a very different lifestyle too. Like, for example, we go on holidays when it's the off season, so it's very cheap. It's much cheaper than other times, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you miss out on all the fun, but you know, we go on things like holidays like that are based on interests, or there's things like homeschool camps, for example, that you can go out in the bush with each other. And sorry, without the ability to take a step back and not have to be constantly on the go and constantly turning up to school 5 days a week, you get to sort of readjust your worldview a little bit. You get to slow down a lot. Growing up as a kid in the mainstream school system, I knew that what I was being taught was not the whole truth, and it was not necessarily accurate. I think that made me give up on learning for a little while. It made me give up on being creative, and it made me think that I was not lots of these things that I actually am, because I didn't conform to this system. So being able to share the truth with my children about colonization, about family history, but not only that, being able to access their culture in a way that I know is safe and that I know is accessible, which I know it kind of sounds like it should be super easy to do. It should be very easy for a disabled child to have accessible cultural experiences, but they really don't happen. And so that was just overwhelmingly a massive kind of huge tick in that this is going to benefit my child in the long run. This is going to benefit him in terms of who he is as a person, but also in terms of how he learns. And, you know, so many times I've left Hendrix tapping away coding on something, and because he's just so focused on what he's doing. Like, it's no spoiler that he has ADHD, so he's hyper-focused on what he's doing, but he has the freedom to learn until his brain says, I can't do that anymore. And, you know, there's just so many opportunities out there for him to engage in. There's so many programs, there's so many groups, there's so many, like, there's just so many opportunities to learn in the world. You know, I've found that most people who offer experiences that are directed at school-aged children are more than willing to offer those experiences to homeschooled children as well. So, you know, I've really not seen any of disservice to my children, you know, because I had a second kid a few years later who didn't go to any form of mainstream school, but he still has a very bright future. He's still confident in his ability to learn, and he's still curious about the world, and he's still culturally really strong in his identity and in terms of his disability and his indigeneity. So, like, yeah, I'm just not seeing the downside to it. There's just so many benefits. I could literally go on all day about it. It's been absolutely life-changing for our family to be able to choose to do this and to have some control over, you know, the narrative of our lives. And that, yeah, it's just a really powerful thing.
Finally, I have a question about community and friendship. Could you talk about how homeschool children can still have community and find friends? And could you also talk about how you also proactively created support for yourself as a home-based educator of your children?
Yeah, look, I was overwhelmed by the amount of community that there is, especially in Victoria, in so-called Victoria, about around homeschooling. You know, My children have been involved in like homeschooling productions, camps. There's just the Home Education Network of Victoria is an incredible organisation. They are all volunteer run from other educators who, Miriam, who has been running the Home Education Network, has, I think she's been home educating for over 20 years or something. It's wherever you turn from the Home Education Network, there is support and there is community and there is, you know, people that I have met that will be long-term friends, lifelong friends that are homeschoolers because of these kind of shared experiences, but also a shared worldview. So yeah, the Home Education Network is just massive. And I also discovered that early on, there wasn't a lot of disability or neurodivergent specific support groups for children that were homeschooled. And the Home Education Network offer public liability insurance. And when I found that out, I was like, wow, then I, you know, that's an obstacle that they're going to help me overcome. And so I started developing, I mean, it sounds very fancy when I say it like that, but it was just a bunch of homeschool families from whatever suburb we were living in at the time. And, you know, we'd hire the local community hall or the local, you know, playgroup after hours centre and get together and just either, you know, sometimes I'd bring along cultural things because I just happened to be doing weaving at home or painting or what have you. But it was more just a chance to build community and to get kids together so that you can, you know, even if it's just like, oh, you know, this person's travelling around Australia with their family and we've met them at this homeschool meet because they've found it on the local group. And, you know, they turn up and you meet them and they travel back to wherever they go. But, you know, we've been friends with them ever since. And so there's just so many times where it's just been a matter of putting myself out there and going, I'll just try, you know, I'll just start this group. And if we go along and nobody comes along, then that's okay. You know, we've got each other and we'll play some games. And, you know, most of the time the community, you know, the community halls, the neighbourhood houses, they're super cheap for community members. And I can guarantee you there'd be at least one other homeschooler around that would be grateful, you know, to come together and do whatever it is. So, yeah, we just started creating these groups because I just thought, if I'm here wanting this local connection with people, there's got to be somebody else. Maybe they just don't know. And I mean, I've moved so many times in my life and I've made new friends so many times that I understand how scary it is. And I'm happy to be the person to reach out and provide that first step. Yeah, because sometimes that's all it takes, you know.
Renee, thank you for your time.
I'm so grateful for a chance to talk about it. And yeah, absolutely. I encourage anyone to look into it and have a think about maybe changing your life up.
That was my friend, Renee Barker-Mulholland, a fountain of knowledge and wisdom. To end this segment of the program, I'm going to play for you now a speech that was delivered by young Koori disability rights advocate and researcher, G. Brown. It was delivered earlier this year at the United Nations COSP 18 General Assembly.
Thank you. My name is G. Brown, born on Red Desert Bangla country with connections to Kirai Wurrung country. I am a young disabled person and the proud older sibling of young carer, my brother Riley. Today I am here alongside Children and Young People with Disability Australia, who are committed to centering the intersecting identities and unique contexts that shape all young people's lives in their advocacy. I acknowledge the sovereign lands of all Indigenous people across the world, particularly those who navigate colonial conflict currently. I carry with me the voices of ancestors, elders, and young disabled Indigenous people. Disabled Indigenous youth are systematically denied personhood, with disproportionate rates of incarceration, institutionalization, and sexual and physical violence. We are not afforded the privilege of being children. Indigenous disabled women and girls continue to be subjected to acts of control that reflect the long history of eugenic violence. Despite these harms, we see young disabled mob leading, often in ways overlooked by policy and uncaptured in unofficial statistics. We care for kin, hold each other through grief and poverty, and use storytelling to speak truth into systems. Culture, country, and community designed, delivered, and owned supports do what Western deficit-based systems cannot: restore dignity and self-determination. we assert the right to exist as full people and to live lives that include not just safety, but joy. This includes the right to the ordinary and the everyday, to go to school, to be with family, to make mistakes and to dream. For those with intellectual and cognitive disabilities, that right is constantly denied. Adulthood is questioned, autonomy is replaced with control, and futures are decided before a young person has had a chance to imagine one. As such, we call for the following. The recognition of Indigenous healing, culture, and country as a fundamental right, and validation as rehabilitation. The end of non-consensual and dehumanizing medical intervention, and of incarceration of children and young people, particularly for those with cognitive and intellectual disability. Equal access to justice and experiences of violence and abuse. The right to joy, safety, rest, kinship, and the everyday things. Investment in community-led initiatives and infrastructure, particularly in remote communities. In line with Children and Young People with Disability Australia's vision for inclusion, these systems must support all disabled children and young people across every area of life, from early years through their education journeys and beyond. Most critically, we call for decolonisation in action. This requires the redistribution of social and political power. For community-led and equal access to justice, it means leadership over consultation and funding that is sustained and controlled. We do not need charity or empty representation. We need power and the deconstruction of colonialism. Power to shape our lives, power to heal, and power to lead. Thank you.
I thank Children and Young People of Disability Australia for their statement.
You're listening to Right Relations, a 3CR Disability Day broadcast special. This next little segment is about care for elders. So I had intended on bringing you a little documentary piece today on Aboriginal community-controlled elder and senior care systems and how much non-Indigenous communities would benefit from following these approaches. When I began preparing this program for you, I was having a conversation with my sister Hamila Ibrahim, who is a fellow black migrant but from the African diaspora, living on unceded Aboriginal land, who has a special interest in elder care, as well as anti-blackness, ageism, sanism, and ableism in healthcare systems and bureaucracy. But I realised through our literally hours of conversation and personal reading on this topic that elder care, services for black diaspora migrant elders, Aboriginal-controlled approaches to elderly care, and how Indigenous elders need more options to live on their own country is a huge topic that deserves its own feature documentary. So stay tuned because that will be coming in the future. For today's show, though, I want to highlight some major changes that the government has implemented to the aged care system that are negatively impacting all of our communities. As of the 1st of November, the Australian government has rolled out the new Support at Home program. These reforms will negatively affect all elderly people by increasing the financial burden on elders and creating more barriers to elders accessing essential care. Under the new reforms, elders could have to pay up to $150 per week for essential services that are deemed, quote, non-clinical, unquote, such as meals, cleaning, transport, and personal care. The Senate has decided to launch new inquiries into the effects these reforms will have. The Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, or VACCHO, is saying that elders need urgent change to ensure they can access equitable and culturally safe aged care. So in response, they have a petition going, calling on fair, equitable and culturally safe aged care. You can visit the VACCHO website and look for the Equity for Elders page. You'll find the petition there. I'm going to play part of a video now that VACCHO released with elders responding to news of these so-called reforms.
I think it's disgusting that they would even ask elders to pay money. I mean, we're supposed to look after our elders. We shouldn't be charging them anything. So, yeah, I think it's bull.
If they want me to pay $150, for me, that means I don't get services. I will suffer when I need it the most. That's not good.
The fact that could be put onto a marginalised group of people who are struggling with the health consequences that we have as we get older is a worry. I don't think it does anything to try to improve to close the gap.
There's 300 a fortnight. That's most of our money left after rent and bills. You wouldn't take it. There'll be so many people saying they don't want to have the aged care package.
Elders are living on the cusp, or either the cusp, entering into poverty. And, you know, people need to have the opportunities to live. It's not the right way to treat our people based around what we're trying to do for our mob. And I think the government need to intervene, think about it, because our life's hard now. We don't want to be harder down the track.
It's so important that they don't do that to us. They needed to talk to us before they made those decisions. But we're all gonna feel that pain, all of us.
You're listening to Right Relations, a special program for 3CR's Disability Day broadcast. I'm Pauline Vatuna, the Disability Day worker. The final segment of this program is about care for country. I'm going to be playing for you some 3CR recordings of senior Golgotha elder Auntie Sue Coleman-Hazeldine. Auntie Sue is the president of the Australian Nuclear Free Alliance and a nuclear test survivor. She's currently actively leading the West Mallee Protection Group, a coalition formed around her and her mob's fight to protect Golgotha country from military testing and continuing colonisation. Auntie Sue Coleman-Hazeldine is an absolutely incredible living cultural library. I believe we owe her our efforts and embodied solidarity with her against massive odds, corporate interests, weapons manufacturers, militaries, and multiple colonising governments. Please read up on this woman. She deserves our utmost respect and solidarity in the struggle to protect country. I'm going to tell you how to support the activism of the West Mallee Protection Group at the end of the program. What you'll hear next is part of an interview Auntie Sue did with Uncle Robbie Thorpe on his 3CR program, Bunjil's Fire.
So tell us where your country is, Sue, so everyone
knows. My country is on the far west coast of South Australia, all out towards the back of Ceduna, including Ceduna and Streaky Bay. And, you know, like, I'm part of a big nation. It's called the Gugudha Nation. And within that nation is all the family clan groups and all. It's sort of like Europe.
And if you go north, you know, that's the Bay, the Great Australian Bight area. And then how far north do you go up?
Go up north way. In the northwest, east, we've got a big area we're looking after, but it's all ancient, precious stuff. You know, precious rock holes, precious story times, dream time stories and stuff.
No, and it's not in the front of most Australians' minds, this place.
No, but what about the animals that they're just indiscriminately destroying?
That's right.
That should be in people's minds.
Yes, and I want to thank you for the work that you do, Sue. And your friends, cleaning.
Yeah, my friends. Without them, I wouldn't be able to do anything.
Yeah, me too. I'm the same, you know. So, yeah, we've got some good friends, and, you know, we're fortunate to have that, but we need a lot more support. I can't even think about my country. You know, it's just so way out of my mind, you know, and struggling to get back to it even.
I'm always thinking about it, and I'm, you know, just go out indiscriminately. And just, we could be out there when the next rocket goes off as well, and we wouldn't even know about it. But that last rocket they sent off, that high-impulse German one, they knew we were on country. And it was like, they didn't care. It was just like another Maralinga, you know? They knew Aboriginal people was on country. They didn't care. They just let those bombs loose, and now they're just letting the rockets go anyway. So, yeah. What do we do, Rob? What do we do?
I don't know, but I think Munji's got a question for you.
Yeah, Munji.
Yeah, so did you say that you had no updates about where this Vida one landed?
Nope.
Mm.
There was some nice little thing put on Facebook where they went and picked this little rocket up, and they didn't have any protective clothing and all that stuff. And you could see that it was just staged.
Yeah, not a very believable photo. and everything undamaged around it. floated down very gently.
Nothing, not even a little squash blade of grass.
Nah.
You know, well and truly staged. And
yeah.
I'm glad I'm not the only one around this place here that's worried, you know, picking up that, because there's a lot of people in Siguna now saying, we don't believe that, which is absolutely great. Where did this rocket land?
Yeah, especially because they were putting warnings out before that little fragments and stuff might land over Siguna. Like, it's not just out in the bush, it's going to be threatened.
You know, when that thing came down, it would have come down with some kind of a thump. And yet that propaganda stuff they put up, it was so perfect.
Well, yeah.
Exactly. So it's radioactive. We're obviously radioactive involved here.
Oh, yeah, and there they are walking out with no protective stuff on, not even a pair of gloves.
So were they gabbas or black people doing that?
Propaganda.
So what can we do, Sue? Like, how can we help?
I guess we
what
can...
We
all,
need? What do you want to say and how can we help?
We need protection for country, right? And the country animals, our special places, we need protection. Because, you know, like... I'm not the only one that goes out onto country. There's a lot of locals that go on country and enjoy country for Easter and, you know, just weekend times they go right out back where it's peaceful, beautiful rocks and scenery and stuff. They don't have that same connection as I do, you know, with the Dreamtime and the sacred sites, but they do enjoy what they go out for. They go out.
Everyone does. Quiet. Everyone loves country, doesn't
matter. Yeah, and these people all need to try and help protect it, even if it's for their own reasons. I don't care, so long as their voices are heard and country is protected and the animals are protected.
So you sense some sort of change in Siguna community there around the environment? And is it getting better or is it the same old same?
Last rocket thing.
Yeah, okay.
With three Chinese warships, nuclear-armed warships in our Great Australian Bight.
Chinese on
time,
ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just on time for that rocket to be coming back, landing, and they would have been tracking that rocket. I mean, we're supposed to be stupid, I think. You know, we're not supposed to put two and two together.
That's interesting, having Chinese ships there.
Three of them. Nuclear-armed.
Gee, they're not saying much about that, are they?
So people are asking the questions, but they need to ask them louder, and they need to demand answers. Why were these Chinese warships in our Great Australian Bight right on the time that rocket was due to land, that one from California?
Okay.
From Varda.
Oh, that is a question to ask.
They need to ask those questions, and they're not believing the propaganda anyway, which is great.
So see that the port of Darwin is owned by China.
Yeah.
And they're going to try and get that lease back.
Just yesterday, wasn't it? China sent out warnings to Australia because both parties want to get the port back from Chinese hands, and they're sending out warnings to Australia.
Yeah, well, look what's happening with the tariff business as well. And
well, that's
going, there's those big shifts going on here, like...
That's Trumpet.
That's Trumpet. So what about Pine Gap here now? A lot of rockets going on.
What about Pine Gap? Yeah. Out in the middle of Australia, away from all the oceans and everything, but... Yeah. And we've got a couple of those big dishes here in Siguna, then we've got the old OTC station, and those dishes are forever pointing towards Pine Gap.
Yeah, of course. It's a big military base, Australia. Pine Gap's
like, again, we're not supposed to notice and we're not supposed to talk about it. We're not supposed to think about anything. You know, we're supposed to just accept what the government and all their cronies say.
Accept their bombs on top of you.
Accept their bombs. Accept whatever crap they're dropping on country.
You can see what they deal with, you know, all around the world, Australia. They're involved in lots of conflict, including Palestine and elsewhere.
Yeah, well, what one lot, Thales, that French weapons company, they want to test guided missiles on country out here.
those guided missiles are then going to be used to kill people, innocents.
Well, that's where they practice all on our country. Australia's behind a lot of global conflicts, like I just said.
I've always said that the killings have started here, you know, with the uranium that's mined to make the atomic bombs.
I think Hitler got a few ideas from out of Australia too, you know, particularly Melbourne, Melbourne University, eugenics and stuff like that.
The killing starts here in Australia with their bloody testing and their mining and everything they're doing, and then it's taken over to innocent people, women and children, and, you know.
Yeah, look at these countries, they've all got the red, white and blue flag, call it AUKUS, and that, you know, and, you know, it's coalition willing. They're terrorists as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
All those countries, Britain, America and Australia.
Yep.
So, you know, we're kidding ourselves. But you've got to keep on fighting no matter what, you know.
Yeah, that's it, you know. I mean, I was scared when we were out on country. I was scared not for myself but for, you know, Manju and Levi and Susie and the two girls from...
Yeah, I worried about them too going out.
I was scared for them.
I know how it works in our organisations. They're scary. You know, I don't trust any of the organisations in Aboriginal Australia, really. They're running corporate bodies and they're money-making things.
None of them.
And unaccountable, misrepresentative.
Yeah, the biggest evil one of the lot is Native Title too.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the reasons why I went to court. You know, I started doing my genocide cases because of I call it naive title. You know, where do the colonisers get the right to make laws for us and determine what our entitlements are in our own country? You know, these racist invaders. You know, I'm not copping that.
And they're using our own people against us.
Yeah, and they sold it, you know, like the cane toad from Northern Queensland and all these other black tokens they use, native police and the neo-native police force in there, the ones that spent $33 billion trying to get us into the Constitution.
And if you get a decent person in there, they soon down them.
That's right. You don't last long.
No, they don't. They finish up being stressed to the max because all the evil around them.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the next election coming up? What you got running over there? You should run yourself.
Elbow's not much, but he's got to be better than Dutton.
Oh, I don't know. But to me, it's a choice between an overt racist and a covert racist. And who's the best liar out of them? You know, I don't even engage. I think people who've got a vote and have a democracy means they don't really have a law. It means they've got to make it up as they go all the time. It's not really an established law, is it? When you've got to keep on making it up. It should be established law one time. Like our law, forever. Never changes, doesn't matter who you are.
That's right, and our law was here a long time before theirs.
That's right, that's the only law for this country.
Yeah.
And it's the only law that's going to save us, I think.
Like I've said it before, and I've said it to a lot of different people, government too. If I break your law, it means I'm upholding mine.
Yes, and that's why a lot of our people fill their jails in this country too.
I've said it over and over and over, and I'll keep saying it too.
Treaties and stuff. They're talking about treaties in Victoria. I wonder if they're going to let all of the prisoners of war out of jail, because that's what we are. We're prisoners of war.
What's the treaty mean? It just gives them the right to...
Well, I reckon we've got to make it mean what we want to make it mean, but they're writing the terms of references and conditions of how it operates, but that's why we want to go take it to the international arena. Where it's, you know, established.
It's got to be for us, not them.
That's right. You don't let the colonising state dictate the terms. That's not a treaty.
No.
So...
No, and that's what it's going to be again. It's going to be under their terms.
That's right. That's what we can't allow to happen. We got to be equal wage in law here. Our law is as good as anybody's. So it's sovereign to sovereign, wherever... And that's what we're talking about. And Australia's not a sovereign body. It's an illegal occupation who are responsible for war crimes, resource theft. Yeah, so they're hardly a proper jurisdiction. We want to do proper law with proper sovereigns, whoever that may be.
If everybody lived by our law, it'd be a better world.
I reckon. We'd have a world.
know,
yeah, we'd have the world to look forward to leave to the next generation, you know.
That's right, yeah. So what's, you still got a bit of a pristine environment out there, or is it getting messed up like everywhere else around here?
It's still, we can still save it. If enough people come on board, we can still save what we have, and it is pristine.
Yeah.
Last wilderness of stunted mallee left in the world, I think.
Yeah.
And some endangered species animals are out there. You know, all our stories, our rock holes, and what we go out and clean. Manju knows all about that.
Mm-hmm.
She's been in the deep end of it all.
it's good that young fellas from places like Melbourne are getting to having a look at country like that.
Well, you know, Melbourne has actually been my backbone with the young ones coming out of there.
Yeah, I must admit,
you know, like there's Tasmania and good. Sydney and wherever, but Melbourne has been the major place.
Yes, we're good educators over here.
And I take advantage of your goodwill.
Absolutely, sis. We are happy to help. You know, we're all connected to this place by our ancient lore and by our, you know, our humanity and all those sorts of things. You know, we don't see anyone doing it tough. Your country is connected to mine, and you know, we all got to look after each other. We always have in the past. It's only when the government and the money comes into the mix, things change.
Yeah.
We're better off on the riverbank, you know.
People still can't see. They take the money from either government, big corps, anybody, and then when the money is gone, they look around, they don't have family.
No.
They don't have country. They've got nothing. They're just shells because they've sold their souls.
And we can't afford to let that happen, keep happening too, because it's costing us the earth.
It's happening and it has happened, but we need to try and stop it. And we number one job of stopping any of that crap is get rid of native title.
Yeah, I reckon. No, that's why we're unceded sovereigns here. We never ceded our sovereignty. We don't recognise Nauru title, all your cultural heritage acts, or any other law that you imposed on us, white man.
Exactly.
So like we want our law properly recognised.
Yeah, my oldies never ceded, and neither have I.
That's right. Yeah. Okay.
If it means standing up in the front of a whole heap of my own people, then so be it. I will do that.
Yeah, that's the truth, sis.
Well,
I
have done that.
That's the difference. Say you make the difference too. Mm. Yeah, need people like yourself standing up, otherwise.
And I've had my little back in there. Had it got out of hand, we would have got flogged, but.
Yeah. Well, you got something going. Yeah. Someone looking after you, ancestors looking after you, sis.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There was proof of that out there as well, eh, Manju?
Oh, yeah, the whirlwind.
No, I'm a great believer in that too. You know, do the right thing by your ancestors.
Oh, yeah. And that's another thing they forget. You know, we keep telling them our ancestors live on country, so it's not uninhabited at all, even though you can't see them. We see them, feel them, sense them, sometimes even see them.
Yes.
All the time.
Yes. Yeah, that's beautiful.
They're there.
They are there. And that's how you got to live your life, like they are there too.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you've got to respect that fact.
Yeah. Well, look, put out a little message of what you need over there. Keep saying that to the very rich town called Melbourne here, what the resources, the wherewithal.
What would our message be? My message would be help me look after country. Help me look after the animals. You know, help me look after the humans, because it all boils down to life, you know, help look after life, because it's getting destroyed badly.
Yeah. And that's the right message. That's the right message. And
hey,
when's the next time you're going to be doing something out there? When next time you're going out in the country, or is that getting a bit risky these days?
My normal time would be September. That's the major trip, but I can go out tomorrow.
Okay.
Anytime.
Or I'll put in a plug for yourself for how people can support you now.
Well, there's the West Mallee Protection Chuft that people can donate to if they can't make it out all the way to.
Okay. How do you get onto that? What is that called?
You can just type it into Google, West Mallee Protection. So there's a Chuft fundraiser that's been set up, and all those. It just helps with costs for Honey Sue's trips, car repairs and stuff,
yes,
forward drives and all of that.
Thanks.
Yeah. Repair the four-wheel drives, yes.
Yes, much needed.
Yeah. And people who are young might want to get involved. And how do they get to go over there with you? Just get in.
Yeah, they've got to get in early if they want to book a seat, because we're always booked out, aren't we, Manju?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. Mm. Lots of people.
Yeah, definitely booked out. I've now got two cars for bush. I only register them when I need to go bush. Okay. But I used to only have the one, and because we just didn't have the cars and whatever, I went ahead and got another one. Now, that's got to be maintained, you know?
You need a couple of troopies, eh?
No, I've got a patrol and a Navara.
Okay, sounds good.
Troopy's a little bit high.
Okay.
I worry that you take them out bush, they might come back looking like a trailer.
Yeah, all right, sis. I've got I'm going to talk to my cousin in a minute on my show. Been good to have you on. Keep us posted what's going on.
Will do. If I find out anything, you know, about the next launch or anything for that matter, I'll ring through, your message.
All right.
No worries.
I'll talk to you soon, though. All right, then.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye, Annie Sue.
That was an interview that Uncle Robbie Thorpe did with Auntie Sue Hazeldine back in April. You can listen to the full episode on the Bunjil's Fire page on the 3CR website. This next clip is of Auntie Sue talking at a West Mallee Protection Group rally on Kaurna land, recorded by 3CR's Radioactive Show back in October.
Now, my name's Sue Hazeldine. I'm sort of the ringleader of this rally. I'd like to welcome everybody here today in support of keeping rockets and any other dangerous missiles off of country, so that our culture, our land, our animals, ourselves can all feel safe and continue into the future for future generations. Because on that land, apart from the animals that are at risk, we have our pharmacy, our school, our church, our shopping centres, because everything is there we need. The pharmacy is our bush medicines. The school is where we teach our children. Shopping centre is where we get all our food off the land. And the church is our spirituality. Our old people are still living on country. Country is not abandoned. And because no one is permanently living there yet, people tend to think that it's uninhabited, but it's not. All the animals that survive need that country to survive are out there. They can't speak for themselves, they just left to die most of the time. So with our help, hopefully we can protect everything that's worth protecting on country and keep all warmongers out. Thank you all for coming today. Okay, everybody, thanks again for coming. The reason that I've brought the campaign to the city is because for years and years I've been fighting to protect country against all comers. And it seems like we're not getting anywhere. So when the threats of the rockets came along, like almost like another Maralinga when they sent that rocket over the top of my head on country, I thought, oh yeah, here we go again. No respect for people on country, no respect for anything. So I thought, okay, we've got to get the word out. And one of the best ways that I could think of was to bring it to the city. So we've travelled a long way to get here to let people in the city know about the struggle that we're having back on country. And it's not just my country either, it's all over Australia, the same struggles are going on. And our rocket launches are going to trash our country, so is the rocket launching that's been given the go-ahead at Whalers Way just out of Port Lincoln. They will kill the little southern emu wrens. There's only about 700 of those left. Right. And those little people can't speak for themselves, like I've said before. So we need all the help we can get to stop this destruction, stop the war materials that are being tested. America, take your own rockets back into your country if you're going to send them off. Don't land them in ours.
I hope you enjoyed all of that wisdom for a very recent update on the West Mallee Protection Group campaign and current activities. Please check out the recent episode of Yilliman. You can find the West Mallee Protection Group on Instagram. That concludes Right Relations, a special program for 3CR's Disability Day broadcast.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.